We are back for the 20-minute VC in Founders Friday with me, Harry Stebbings, and following from our episode with Alfred Lin at Sequoia on Wednesday, we're joined by an incredible Sequoia founder today in the form of Hubert Pallan, founder and CEO at Product Board, helping product managers understand what customers need, prioritize what to build next, and rally everyone around the roadmap. To date, Hubert has raised over $64 million for Product Board from some of the best, including Sequoia, Index, Kleiner Perkins, Bessemer, and Credo Ventures, to name a few. Prior to founding the company, Hubert was VP of Product Management at Good Data, where he played an instrumental role in their scaling from 6 to 300 people. I'd also want to say a huge thank you to Iliad Kleiner and to Andrew at Sequoia for some amazing questions and suggestions today. I really did so appreciate that. But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20 VC listeners get 10% off at secureframe.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. But enough from me, so let's head into the show, and I'm so excited to welcome Hubert Pallan, founder and CEO at Product Board.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Hubert, it is such a joy to have you on the show today. I've heard so many great things from the team at Sequoia and then obviously the wonderful and charming Mr. Iliad KP. So thank you so much for joining me today.
So kind to hear. I'm grateful to be here.
I do want to kick off though with some context about you. So tell me, how did you make your way into the world of startups and how did you come to found the game changer that is Product Board today?
Yeah, so quick background. I got master's in computer science in Prague, Czech Republic. I'm from there and then made it through 4 years of technology and strategy consulting at Accenture with clients around Central Eastern Europe. And then I got my MBA at Berkeley. And that was the entry to the US. And after that, I got sucked into the Valley. And, you know, I'm talking about the CS and MBA background because I see that as the foundation, the combination, the technology and business, you know, combined knowledge. That was the success later on. And after the MBA, I went through a couple startups, some successful than the others, and then ended up growing to be a VP of product management at an Andreessen funded BI company called Good Data. I discovered there the reality of product management at high growth startups in the Valley and just here in the tech world. And I kind of learned that my idealized MBA educated and Accenture framework trained brain and approaches, you know, are slightly different from just like, let's see what sticks way of approaching building startups, you know, in many of the tech companies. It was an interesting moment. It's like, oh, wow, it's not as thought out as it should be. And then, so what happened was that, you know, at Good Data, it was startup, everything was crazy. And I remember sitting there one day looking at all the Jira tickets, engineering task management system. And I was thinking, wait a minute. So product management and kind of the, you know, the art and craft of building new product is all about understanding the customers and their needs and then figuring out what to build for them, right? What are the features and functionality? And all the systems I've been using didn't have the customers and needs in it. I mean, it's crazy. You know, the Jira is all about epic stories and tasks. There's not even the entity of a customer, the need or the objective is kind of, you know, core entity of that system. And this was back in 2014. And, you know, now I quit and now Product Board is a product management system. It's used by over 3,000 companies to get the right products to market faster. And we have, you know, Zendesk, Disney, Slack, but also traditional companies like Swarovski, Cartier, Sherwin-Williams, McLaren, you know, people that are undergoing digital transformations. And we keep working on it.
Listen, it's been an incredible journey over the last few years. I'm really interested. question. This is where I said to you ahead of time, we do go off schedule. I had recently Vlad Tenev from Robinhood on the show, and he spoke about kind of his growing up in Eastern Europe and how it impacted his mindset. How do you think growing up in Czech Republic and then making the move to the US, how did that impact your mindset, do you think, as a founder and operator?
I think that you kind of idealize it from, you know, externally, and you think that everything is thought out. And then when you realize that it isn't, when you kind of get thrown into it and you ask, you know, people that you respect and that you thought was like, oh my God, this is a, you know, God, and they just have the formula and they have the recipe to build the companies. It just makes you like, you basically go and you're more bold, I feel like, you know, you're just like, okay, even these people don't know, so it's up to me and I just need to work extra hard and I need to like put extra effort. And then also because you have this, you're super frugal, you know, you're coming from a world where you had to do everything, you need to figure out everything, you're like, you didn't have the funds. And so the early days, and it's kind of a double-edged sword, but you know, the early days is kind of like, okay, I'm just gonna rough it on ramen, but just like, that's how I grew up. So it's like, you know, it's like, oh, it's so hard. I mean, it is hard, right? But it's like, you're more resilient, I feel like, you know.
Speaking of kind of, I'm gonna rough it on ramen and like the frugality that's instilled within you there because of the background, is it difficult then when you raise a big Series B from Sequoia and suddenly you have to transition mentally from frugality to aggressive spending?
Look, number one, it's not just raising, right? It's like you raised the round, but really what matters is whether you have the signals in the business that show you that you should be scaling. So just careful with, you know, raise money and start spending. But the, even though hopefully you raised the money because you saw the signals, right? But I mean, for me, it's been a challenge, like how to realize that maybe you can spend more and move faster rather than be frugal and just, you know, try things slowly. And that's one of the things I would probably change looking back. But, you know, the good thing is that if you have it in you, and as we all heard, you know, the culture comes from the top, like you kind of project it to the company. And so, I mean, look, running an efficient business, talk to any investor, like, you know, okay, what's the ratios, sales and marketing spend towards the revenue that you bring in? Like, it's a critical factor, right? So it's actually very, very valuable to have that mindset. And that's the story of Jeff Bezos and, you know, like One Pizza Team, just like, you know, be frugal.
Totally with you. I love that element of hindsight, because I do want to start today with kind of the founders themselves. I mean, today we're going to unpack a load of like conventional wisdom that everyone says in the industry, and maybe we have different slants. The first is like founder insights. And you said before that founder insight is overrated. Now, I love a statement like this. So tell me, why is founder insight overrated?
Yeah, so look, it's important to have an insight, right? Because if you don't have an insight, if you don't uncover something new in the market, the new opportunity, the new need, then it's like, you know, you don't have a business. Like, you need to do that. And if you look at, you know, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, Phil Knight at Nike, Oprah Winfrey, even like Payal Karakia at ClassPass, they represented the target audience. The early on, I joked that Mark Zuckerberg was a socially deprived college kid, you know, and that's why he built the company he built. But it also, look at how many startups pivot. And so in my mind, you know, while you might have the early insights, you actually don't know whether it is the insight that's going to be the foundation of the large, big company that you will scale. And so to me, it's much more about the flexibility of the founder and not holding these insights too strongly. And there's many people who are very stubborn and who hold their opinions super strongly. You know, they have this reality distortion field around them and they persuade others that like, oh yeah, this is like the best thing. So that's one aspect of it. I feel like the self-awareness and, you know, being ready to pivot. I mean, look at Stuart Butterfield, right? From game to Slack, right? It's a very different flexibility. And then the second thing that I would highlight is it's not just the founder. Again, the people I named, you know, there's the teams around them. And I, from what I see, the best product teams, I mean, we're a product management company, right? So it's a product, like how they approach it. It's actually the teams that really figured out how to share the insights and how kind of unblock the communication lines between people. And so that it's not like a founder, I know what to do, there's a directive, and I'm like a general gonna tell the teams, like, you go here, you go here, you go here. It's much more around, here's the model, here is the structure, here is like, you know, the segment of the market, the personas, here are the needs, here's competitive alternatives. How can we all get together and figure out what is a superior solution? And it requires much more collaborative thinking. And so that's, you know, what I say, like the founder insight, yeah, it's there, but it's just like very small part of the whole story.
So I have to unpack a couple of elements that you said about the mental plasticity there to kind of be flexible to move. The question is, we hear about the reality distortion field and how founders have to be persistent persistent above everything and keep going. How do you balance between being realistic when something's not working, but then also having a vision and sticking to that vision?
Great question. I think that you need to have a framework around it. You need to know why you have that conviction. Because if the conviction is just because, you know, you woke up one day and you thought like, yeah, this is the thing, or you found out that you as an individual have a need and you have an insight how to solve it, or like the insight was the combination of the need and the solution. But then you need to go and you need to find out whether there's more people like you. So you need to have a way how to kind of validate that and validate just like, is it a need that's big enough, that's like painful enough, right? Is there enough people out there that have the similar need? And do I have really a superior way how to solve it? And then the conviction can be coming from, well, I am constantly kind of validating that, yes, the need is there. Maybe I don't have the solution yet, but I see that the need is there. Yes, I see the market, there's more people. Maybe I don't have the solution. Or vice versa. You know, you might be convinced about great technology, but then you need to go and find the market for it. But it needs to be, you know, it needs to be in my mind. And, I'm a computer scientist, you know, like I'm a very analytical person, right? But in my mind, you need to have a systematic approach how to think about it. And the conviction shouldn't be just like an uninformed gut feeling. It needs to be very much informed gut feeling. And you need to be able to challenge all the inputs that go into the, you know, the conviction.
The other thing that struck me when I was listening to you is, you know, I'm an investor for my sins today, Hubert. My question to you is that you said about the team itself and kind of the depth of the team beneath the leader. For investors, you and I both know that the majority of the communications is between the lead on the investor side and the CEO. How do you think, or if you were an investor, how would you engage with the team to determine that depth within the startup when making a decision?
Well, I mean, look, the best investors want to meet the team. I agree with you that the majority of the communication, and also, look, it depends on the stage of the company, right? But if I look at our, even the early round, Series A, like Ilya Fishman showed up at our office, you know, for people here at WeWork, but like he wanted to see the other people, he wanted to talk to people. So like, you know, he did a very good diligence. And then back channel, talk to people who interacted with the company and see how people communicate, like what they stand for. It's not just, it's a team sport. My point is that it's how the founding people work and collaborate with the others. What is that relationship? Is it very dictatorial, or is it kind of meritocracy, egalitarian? Is it, you know, respecting each other's opinions?
What relationship do you go for? Because you've got different styles of leadership. They've all worked, and then there's all that haven't worked. Which do you prefer and why?
I want to be a dictator. No. I go for the, look, like the whole premise of Product Board as a system is based on the idea that the information should be shared with all the people that are involved in product decision making. It's similar, like, you know, CRM system, like you centralize all the data about customers in order to disseminate it across the company so that sales see it, marketing sees it, you know, customer support, success, like you have fullest picture of the customer as possible. And this is missing on the product side. And so my point is that you need to create an environment where this is shared and where everybody's on the same page. And that's my way of leadership. Like, I still don't have the magical recipe, but I'm trying to like write down my insights that I've learned for the past 6 years and draw diagrams and have everybody read it. And then I, you know, write down my roadmap that I have in my head for features for the next 24 months. But it's not like this is the roadmap. It's like, hey, I'm seeding the conversation with this because I've been thinking about it for 6 years. And then let's talk about it. We can change it. It's not set in stone. You know, it's just like, I want you to not reinvent the wheel, because if you just join the company, there's 6 years of knowledge and learning about the market, and somehow you need to get it. It's super hard. Like, I don't have a magic. I heard these stories that, you know, at Sprinklr, the founder had the first marketing leader living in his basement for 3 months so that they could just get on the same page and talk all the time. You know, Drew at Dropbox, I heard that when he hired the chief product officer, the product leader, that they spent like every week, like 6 hours or like crazy amount of time for months just talking about the vision and what's happening, just so that you get aligned as much as possible.
I do have to ask, you mentioned kind of sitting there and mapping out the product vision. In terms of kind of product visions, you said before that big and bold product visions are great, but they can be dangerous. I'm interested, what are the downsides to big and bold product visions, considering they're traditionally held in this kind of heroic sense?
Yeah, we need to think big and bold, because if you don't think big and bold, you're not going to make anything big and bold. The thing though is that, like, I can ask you, how many times have you heard a founder telling you something like, oh, we're a solution for everyone, or anybody can be a customer? It's great that you have that bold vision, but the danger about it and the tough thing is that if somebody somebody shows up and says like, I'm building a flying car so that anyone could fly to work, is that that's not how you go about building the company. And that's not how you, like, you know, from getting the vision can be big and long term, but how you get there needs to be a thought out, deliberate set of small steps. And if you don't think hard about what is the right set of steps to get there, and if you just like start building the bold vision, you know, it's like starting to build a city, and instead of first building a church and a, you know, school and a hotel and a pub, like you would build from Metropolis like one little, you know, stone from each of the buildings, and then, you know, you build half of the first story and you run out of funding because nobody can move in anywhere. And so that's the thing, like you have to have a bold vision, but the bold vision, you need to have the insight that what is it that you're gonna be in 5 years is not what you should be building today. And that's the key of the strategic perspective. And what's the first milestone, the second milestone, the third milestone? And also have make sure that the investors understand it, that everybody around you understand the path that is, you know, because if you sell people on the bold vision and you tell them, oh, this is what we can deliver this year, and they, you know, you get the valuation, they fund you based on that, but then it turns out that to get there is more like 10 years, they're in pickle.
Can I ask, in terms of like, you said there about kind of strategic milestones to get there, when you think about adding products, I always think about kind of the importance of knowing what your core is as a company. And when you add a second product, you're potentially moving away from core. So how do you think about when and why is the right time to add secondary products?
Yeah. So this is the core product strategy thinking. Like what you're asking about is that's the foundation of product strategy. If you think at how companies that we all know went to the market, you know, Tesla, first Roadster, then sedan, then mass market vehicle. Salesforce, start with Sales Cloud, then add, you know, support services, marketing, you know, now acquire Slack, right? Like, you know, you go deliberately to the market, not saying like, I'm a system for everything for everybody. Spotify, music first, and then adding, you know, podcasts and maybe video content and so on. Like it's deliberate. And so the key elements there though are, who is the customer in terms of the persona? Is it, you know, is it somebody, and I'm in a B2B world, right? So it's like, I'm giving you B2B examples, but is it somebody who's in marketing versus sales versus customer success? And then what are the needs is the second dimension. And so the customers and the needs and the intersection is where your product is and where the competing products are. And so you need to think about, okay, I built the first version of the product for the first persona and for the first set of needs. What am I going to do now? Am I going to take that product and enlarge it, increase the breadth of it and add additional needs? Or am I going to go and add a new persona? It turns out that typically it's easier to stay in the same persona and add needs. So for example, within sales, right? If Salesforce is building the sales product, you could keep adding more functionality for more sophisticated sales or more sophisticated sales use cases rather than jump to the marketing persona. Because with jump to a new persona and to kind of like a big segment comes suddenly new go-to-market messaging and positioning, a new set of competitors. And is, you know, that jump is much bigger. It comes with the need to learn about the needs of this new market segment. And so I remember when I was at Berkeley, the marketing professor said, like, turns out that if the same company introduces new products to the existing audience, there's a much higher likelihood of success than if you introduce the same product to a new market. Because the market knowledge and the understanding of the needs of the people is more important, you know, than the product knowledge. In terms of you, like what is core and what is it where you should move? Like you need to understand the segmentation. You need to have the good understanding of the market structure. And then based on your capabilities, based on where competition is, how differentiated you are, you need to kind of like draw on that little matrix. You know, okay, I'm going to go broad or I'm going to go deep. Or, you know, where am I going to encounter biggest competition? How am I going to be differentiated? You know, again, it's an analytical exercise. It comes at cost. And, you know, it's complicated, yeah, but it's important to be certain.
I love this discussion. It takes me to my biggest question right now. I'd love your help on it, Hubert, which is like, I think we're entering this period of like mass consolidation where you mentioned a couple of the big incumbents there. Salesforce acquiring Slack is a great recent example, but like, you know, it's one of many. I think we're going to see this wave of consolidation as the first wave of mega incumbents in SaaS now start to acquire the second gen and really really start to bundle what has been quite an unbundled ecosystem. Do you agree with me? And how do you think about the consolidatory period and the bundling versus unbundling?
Yeah, I mean, totally, this is happening. I agree with you on that. I think that is natural. I don't think this is anything specific to technology. It's just that, you know, in this particular like SaaS world, for example, in this example, right, it's getting to the whole industry is getting to the maturity where the big players have the funds. And also to your question, like, when is the right time to branch out? Like, you need to have actually a defensible business in the thing that you did in the first place, right? Because if you start expanding too soon, then you start competing with multiple people at the same time. And I mean, you see it, for example, in support, right? Zendesk, Intercom, Drift, the competition is increasing along the different use cases. And like, you know, competing with everybody at the same time, it's a difficult challenge for Intercom, right? Like, how do you take on Zendesk and then at the same time protect yourself from the entrance at the bottom, like Drift? But this consolidation, in my mind, so it's like, okay, are there players who can add it into their suite of products, like the acquisition to their suite of products, so that it strategically all makes sense and so that there's a more combined value created for a customer if they then use the whole platform? And then in terms of the companies that are being acquired, it also requires that there are companies that like found new market opportunities and develop them into already kind of like a validated businesses that are worth acquiring. I feel like we're reaching this point, but still there needs to be a specialization. I'm still a bit like, if you look at Notion or Coda, you know, the companies that are just like a no code, low code kind of solution, you can combine or apply it for everybody. I still believe that there needs to be specialized solutions for highly specialized use cases. And just like with Excel, like Microsoft Access, I don't know whether you remember, but you would build your CRM in a spreadsheet or in Microsoft Access, right? And then with a specialized solution turned out. You can do the same thing with Notion. You can theoretically run all the processes, but it's not going to be world-class outcome out of it. Maybe you can get away with it if you're a small startup, but when you scale, it's not going to work.
And Tony, I think that's the biggest product marketing challenge ever, which is when you have such horizontal platforms, finding the vertical specific use cases, and then how do you do that from a product marketing perspective without alienating everyone else who's not dentists or whatever it's going to be. I do want to ask, you know, in the scale to that kind of consolidatory period, you have to get product market fit. Everyone talks about it in the industry, and you know, there's a lot of different opinions. You said before, it's so great to achieve it, but if you got there by accident, you might be in trouble. Why is that? Because people just think once you hit product market fit, you know, life's a breeze. So don't laugh. But why could you be in trouble if you get there by accident? And what are the dangers?
If you stumble into it, you just like, you know, you're throwing spaghetti on the wall and you see what sticks, which by the way, is a lot of the kind of lean startup thinking is actually just like iterate quickly, right? Like the agile, just iterate quickly, quickly, quickly. There's not much about strategy. It's much about high volume, you know, of tests. So my point here is that the strategic aspect needs to be there. If you just go and you stumble into it by accident because you saw something or you tried it and you don't really have that system in place that allows you to consistently go forward and validate and test and iterate in a smart strategic way, you're in trouble. Because what happens when you get to the product market fit is that the market at that point starts pulling you all these different directions. On the little matrix that I described, you know, people start asking you, oh, can you do more use cases and kind of like, you know, more broader. And then other people who are not really the persona that the product is for, see it and they like some aspect on the product of it and is like, oh, this is great. Can I also use this tool? You know, I know it's a sales tool, but I could use it for marketing or for us, like product management. Oh, it's great, but I would also like to use it for my personal task management because you guys have this flexible hierarchy and it would be so awesome and I can put a mind map. And so if you don't have the muscle of thinking strategically and systematically about it, the risk is that you will start responding to all these asks and it's like, oh, this is great. The market will pull us where we need to be. But without the strong lens, the strategic lens, you're in trouble. Because if you just, you know, deliver the feature that is the ask of the biggest customer in your pipeline, and the customer is, you know, like the salespeople are so great at selling to everybody, if it's not focused to the ideal customer segment that you hopefully should have defined, then you're going to end up just in the example with the city, right? You're just throwing random stuff in it and the product kind of starts bloating and you slow down. And so I would argue that this is the biggest challenge for most of the companies. Like, I mean, we don't hear about the people who don't have the bold vision, right? I'm sure that there's many people, but you just don't hear about them. But it's like, how do I get to the vision? Don't confuse the vision with what am I gonna do this quarter or this year, and then have a very deliberate way how to get there. So I know it's, you know, it's all tied together, but it's definitely like product market fit. Yeah, done. Because it's typically just a sliver. If you want to build a big company, the initial product market fit is just a small subset of the company that you're going to build. It's a small, small segment, and it's a small set of needs that you're satisfying. But how do you go from there?
The thing that I'm really thinking, and it's kind of adjacent and aligned to this, and it's like the core way that people often, especially engineering teams, hear the customer pull into a new feature, a new market, a new segment, whatever that is often through customer success or through sales teams providing that feedback to them. My question to you is, like, given that product board is obviously so rooted in product teams, how did you think about pricing? Because the per seat pricing model wouldn't take advantage of all the value that you'd be creating. So how do you think about pricing? What was the thoughts there for you?
It's the sequence. So we are going through the market where we're starting with the needs of the core product people. And so we are now charging by seat because it makes the most sense, because the core, and that's not just product managers, by the way. You know, there's, you'd be surprised for how, you know, for every product manager, there's like three other people who are part of the product process. You know, I mean, designers, engineers, but even product marketers, and there's other stakeholders, and there's, you know, the customer success, head of customer success, and sales. They all want to be involved because product is so central to the success of the company and also to the success of their individual teams, right? If you have better product, it sells better. If you have better product, customer success is an easier job, and, you know, support and so on. And then how you get the insights into the other teams, you need to be organized around that. You know, it's not just the product people, but it's next for us. And so all the use cases that are around how customer success can leverage the information in product board and then present roadmap directly to the customer, customers and sales teams and so on. So right now we have all these seats free and we are not monetizing them. But it doesn't mean that once we have the like super strong foothold in the product organization and all the product makers, that we're not going to come up with a way to monetize that. Whether it's through another role that's monetized, whether it's through another modules, or, you know, even like a whole set of, yeah, like modular products. And there we're going to monetize the relationships of the other contributors with the product organization.
Would you say the biggest challenge for you moving forward is the proof of being able to monetize outside of product teams?
I don't know whether it's the biggest challenge. It's just like one of the challenges of building,
one of many challenges.
Scaling a company, it's part of it, you know?
Yeah.
Look, there's other ways to do it. If you look at Envision or Figma, you know, that's growing like crazy. They monetize active users and doesn't matter who it is. And, you know, maybe that's a way too, right? Maybe then you create kind of like a blended role where you lower the price per seat, but more types of users are going to be paying. And so overall, the revenue will increase. There's different ways how to do it.
I do want to touch on one final point though, and it's kind of core to the product vision with that product board. And it's, you mentioned obviously the kind of key essence of sharing. And it makes me think of transparency, because again, we've spoken before and you said it's necessary but hard. So I guess the thing that I wanted to ask is, like, why do you feel it's necessary first?
Well, look, like, what are you doing as a startup founder? You're trying to hire super smart people to help to get you to your vision. And not only want to build trust with them by being transparent and honest, because that's what people appreciate and, you know, expect, hopefully, but also because you want their help in solving the hardest problem. And so if you're not sharing things that are not working, if you're not transparent about the performance, if you don't talk about the inconvenient information that you just lost a big customer, or that, you know, the churn is high, or just in general the friction in the business, the big problems, well, what are you doing? So you spend all the effort on hiring these great people, and then you completely waste their curiosity and creativity in helping you solve the best difficult problems that you have in the business. And to me, that's a crime. Just like you're wasting, you know, people's abilities and skills. So that's the core for me. I can tell you why it's difficult, but this is why transparency is important.
So now we know why it's so important. I've got a couple of kind of pushback situations on that.
Sure.
Like, yeah, fundraising, M&A, big strategic moves, all incredibly distracting to the organizations of any kind or size. I don't think it's helpful to be transparent on them. Am I right or am I wrong?
Well, I think that transparency is not, it's not binary. It's not nothing or everything, right? It's a continuum. Look, there's some hard limits. privacy regulations. Like, you just can't. You can't be transparent if you would be breaking law and if you're breaking protection or, like, you know, rights of people to keep private medical information or, like, you know, obviously you're not sharing that, right?
Right. I see, but
yeah, right. And then the second, though, is the strategic bucket. Like, if you're in the middle of closing a big round and you have investors competing for you and you're trying to keep secret, you know, from them, like, you don't want to tell the whole company, like, hey, you know, we have Sequoia and Kleiner and Andreessen and Accel compete and, you know, we're pitting them against each other and trying to create the best outcome for us. Like, no, you're risking that it's going to leak and, you know, it's a super sensitive time period, right? It's a very short time period, though. And so you need to be careful there. But that doesn't mean that after the fact, you shouldn't and couldn't share that. You can go and then say, like, look, like, you know, this happened. Like, this is, you know, it's strategically important to keep information confidential for some period of time. But, like, let me tell you the stories and, you know, crazy stories that happen and be transparent so that you get people, like, feel like they were part of it, even though it obviously, you know, not the whole company can be part of the narrow discussion.
No, I get you. And I think that kind of openness and transparency post makes it a little bit easier and nicer to digest.
I want to say, if I may, to the transparency, is that it's hard in the set. Like, look, I use this analogy. Imagine that you're a general, you're fighting a war, and then competitors start, you know, winning and undercutting you from the right. And you show up, you would stand in front of the whole army and you would say, things are not looking good. It looks like you're being overpowered. Like, you know, it's demoralizing, right? And that's the very hard part about it. Because if you're honest about the fact that you're going through a couple quarters that are not great and you're losing large customers, it requires from people, from everybody, to understand kind of a longer term game and the fact that, yeah, you lose some, you win some, right? And that you will go and you will, over a longer period of time, turn it around. But that means that the people need to be resilient and informed and kind of, you know, enlightened from that perspective, because otherwise they might freak out. And that's the hard part. But I still, you know, I still like to err on the side of, let's just tell people that things are not going great and hope that we can fix it. And the people that are going to leave are likely the people who don't believe in the mission of the company and who are there maybe because, you know, Sequoia invested or because, like, yeah, they wanted to be just on the rocket ship that goes up and to the right. But there, you know, pretty much every company has gone through rough periods. That's the reality. You know, we don't talk about that much, right? But as a founder, that's what I ask about. If I'm raising a round, I'm asking about an investor and I'm asking for, you know, back channeling, like, what were they like during the rough periods? Like, what happened when there were quarters flat and, like, what was the reaction? And these stories are not frequently shared.
I'm too interested, Chiba, and then we will get into the quick fire. You're such a happy, jolly, nice guy. No, seriously, it's so lovely. It's infectious. But, like, when times are hard for you, how do you deal with it? What's the Hubert like then?
Oh, yeah. Look, like, I'm 42, I think. But I've been working on this. I've been super stressed. And in the early days of Product Board, you know, it's been hard. And I had a little founder's mood meter. I put into a spreadsheet how I feel and I plotted it because I'm an analytical guy. It was a complete, you know, ups and down. I meditate. I talk to my wife. I surround myself, you know, with mentors and I kind of spread the burden. But I kind of got to the moment where I realized that, number one, don't stress about things that are outside of your control, because it's completely counterproductive. And number two, any kind of stress is counterproductive if it limits your ability to think clearly. And so I'm just, like, doing everything I can to just, you know, be balanced and approach things from a positive, we can figure things out. But I had to learn that. It wasn't natural.
Isn't I love that, plotting it on a graph. That's a brilliant answer. I do want to move into the quick fire round there now, Hubert. So you say a short statement, you give me your immediate thoughts. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Okay, so let's start on the favorite book and why. What must we be reading?
One that stands out is High Growth Handbook by Elad Gil. I know never you heard of that one, but that was just so practical for a founder. And there is a lot of the things, like how to put board together and how to think about, you know, fundraising, like super practical. I would say that one.
I had Elad on the show when he released it. So yeah, love it, know it. What would you most like to change about the Silicon Valley tech scene?
One that actually I've been thinking about recently, given the election, I feel like we all in technology, we are pulling society towards innovation and we have a responsibility not to forget about the people who are not on the front lines of innovation. And so I think that I actually have, like, I'm on the side, I'm working on starting a little nonprofit nonprofit or a little group of what can we do to get people on the bandwagon of using technology and being more flexible in how they work and what work they can get done. Because, you know, it's like there's this group of people that are running faster because they are more informed. They have, you know, the cars dealt their way. They have the skills and the knowledge, and we're just running faster and faster and faster. There's this like gigantic group of society that doesn't have the information, doesn't have the skill, and we can't just like run too far away because it's going to create a very strong tension. And the rate of change is increasing. The innovation, the speed of innovation is increasing. And we need to do something to kind of keep everybody together, because otherwise, you know, I mean, you see the polarization in the political system. I think it is because of the much faster rate of change.
Tell me, what keeps you up at night?
My kids. You asked me about it. I sleep well because of the focus on mental health. Like, I don't wake up. In general, you know, what I think about or what I worry about, it's like, how do we scale the company? How do we grow? You know, like, there's so many things to figure out. How do we hire even better people? You know, it's like all the things that are just like scaling, building a successful company.
Why is hiring product managers so fucking hard?
It's a complex role. It's a combination of customer empathy, design, business, technology. I'd say it's getting better because I feel like there's more and more people who understand technology more. You know, we kind of came from the world where you had like the traditional brand manager. It's basically a product manager. You know, at Procter & Gamble, if you have diapers as a brand, like that, you know that. But it's easier to understand the needs of the customers there than it is in the tech world. But I feel like as the new generations are coming in and they kind of understand more how technology works and how it is used by people, the easier it is to find people who understand both the needs and technology. But in the early days, you would have to be a super techie and almost, you know, because of that, you wouldn't have the empathy. And so it was then the Frankenstein product got built. It was like super technical, super difficult to use because they were built and designed by engineers. And just, it's changed in the last 20 years.
Tell me, which angel has done the most to help the company and how?
Well, you're asking about investor angels, right? But I want to highlight my wife and in general, like the support that founders get from the families. Because if you think about the level of investment that they put into the venture and, you know, whether it's living on the ramen or sleeping on a mattress in an empty apartment while you move into your real apartment, your co-founders, like I did, it's just like, you know, a lot. Death Trainer is an angel, the more traditional angel. And I learned so much from him about product strategy, the co-founder of Intercom. So I would mention him.
That's a great one. Good old Dez. Dez and your wife. I mean, he's held in like...
I wonder what she's going to say.
She's going to love it. Yeah, just don't play into it. Just skip this section. Anyway, I do want to finish on the most exciting of all day, Hubert, which is the next 5 years for you. So what are the next 5 years for you and for Product Board? And I guess just how big could this be?
Well, I think of it as like becoming the Salesforce of product management, becoming the central product brain. Like, you know, Salesforce is the CRM and is the business brain of the company. But we need a brain that is focused on understanding the markets and their needs for the product side, for the R&D organization. Well, everything that we talked about, who are the customers? What do they need? Who are the competitors? And how do you translate all of it into the product decision making? And we don't have that. That doesn't exist. Like, where can you go and ask, oh, what are the top needs of a specific customer segment? Or what are, you know, if I build this particular feature functionality, who's going to benefit from that the most? You know, it's mind-boggling. It's just crazy. And so another analogy is like, think of it as, you know, in Star Trek, the command bridge. And so I want to be product board like that place where all the information from the market are coming in and all the exploration, you know, the units, it's like bringing in, and then you disseminate, you analyze it, you see the big picture, and then you, you know, communicate back like, hey, this is what we should do. And so that's kind of just like a, you know, fun way to think about it.
I've absolutely loved this. I wish everyone had your energy and charisma and enthusiasm. It would make my job so much more wonderful. But this has been so much fun. So thank you so much for doing this today.
Thank you, Harry. You're an awesome guy too. I really enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
I mean, what a positive force of energy. I just loved interviewing Hubert there. And if you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. I always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll. And for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Carter. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carter can help. Check them out at carter.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that it is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20 VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. As always, I so appreciate all your support, and on Monday we have an incredible episode coming out, so stay tuned, and I so appreciate it.